Harry, at the Sundance Film Festival, when the documentary about him premiered, talking fully about his life and so much more. That does it for our show. On Saturday, Juan Gonzalez will deliver the opening plenary address at a day-long policy forum at American University titled In Search of a New U.S. Policy for a New Latin America, Burying 200 Years of the Monroe Doctrine. Visit democracynow.org for more information. Oh, and special thanks to our archivists Brendan Allen and Charina Nadura for today's show. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnock, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Chanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21 in Portland. Once a Braided River is a documentary film by Barbara Bernstein. The film tells the story of the Willamette River before it was transformed into a Superfund site. The documentary features community groups and activists working to replace the zone and explores their vision to reclaim this stretch of river as a place where people and wildlife can thrive. Again, that's Once a Braided River on Tuesday, May 16th from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Cinema 21, 616 Northwest 21st Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Support for this program comes from KABU members and from the League of Women Voters of Portland, providing nonpartisan election information for the May special election at lwvpdx.org. The website has explanations of ballot measures on services for renters and for children and public safety. The League informs voters because every vote matters.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Now it's time for your 5 o'clock evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, a major lawsuit over the Labor Day 2020 wildfires begins.
Toy company Mattel unveils a Barbie doll with Down syndrome.
And in international news, Pope Francis allows women to vote at a bishop's enclave.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, April 26, 2023. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Josh Salem. A trial connected to a $1.6 billion class action lawsuit over the catastrophic 2020 Labor Day wildfires in Oregon started yesterday in Portland. The fires killed 9 people, burned more than 1,800 square miles in the state, and destroyed more than 5,000 homes and other structures. Pacific Corp is the primary defendant in the litigation. The reason alleged is that the Portland-based utility, Oregon's second largest, did not shut off power to its 600,000 customers during a big windstorm. Its power lines have been implicated in multiple blazes, one of which started in its California service territory and burned its way into Oregon. Jurors in the Multnomah County trial will determine the company's responsibility, if any, in 4 of those blazes. These include the Santiam Canyon fires east of Salem, the Echo Mountain Complex near Lincoln City, the South Obenchain fire near Eagle Point, and the 242 fire near the southwest Oregon town of Chilicon. The lawsuit may reshape the way Oregon's electric utilities respond to wildfire risks in climate change and drought conditions. A lawyer for the plaintiffs said the fires were predictable and preventable, and that they devastated the lives of thousands of Oregonians. Nicholas Rosinia told jurors, quote, "They had the knowledge, they understood, and they chose to do nothing," end quote. Doug Dixon is an attorney representing Pacific Corp. He disputed the charge the company's lines caused 3 of the 4 fires and most of the resulting damage. He told jurors that Pacific Corp acted similarly to most other utilities that did not proactively cut power. Pacific Corp had allegedly been repeatedly warned by state regulators for deficient tree trimming and vegetation management around its power lines. The utility's employees were also told that the National Weather Service issued increasingly alarming forecasts about the coming Labor Day windstorm and the extreme fire danger. A warning came from the utility's own contract meteorologist as well, according to the plaintiff's lawyer.
Rosinia then told jurors a power shutoff was the only option left to the utility to prevent wildfires, but he said Pacific Corp never seriously considered doing so. Dixon, the Pacific Corp lawyer, said the plaintiffs were trying to blame Pacific Corp with an overly simplified hindsight version of what happened. He cited the so-called realities of climate change and the role that forest management has in causing and preventing wildfires. Dixon added Pacific Corp was the first company in the Pacific Northwest to develop a wildfire preparedness plan. They identified areas in their service territory at high risk of wildfires and had a rollout plan for public safety-related power shutoffs. It also boosted spending on tree pruning in the last 2 years before the fire. Dixon called a shutoff a measure of last resort that comes with its own risks to public safety. Pacific Corp also intends to challenge whether its power lines and the fires they ignited in the Santiam Canyon caused property damage to most of the plaintiffs in the class action suit. It blamed those damages on a lightning-caused blaze miles away. The trial will determine Pacific Corp's liability and any actual property damages for 17 named plaintiffs, each of whom is also seeking $3 million in non-economic damages for emotional distress and suffering. It is expected to last at least 6 weeks.
The toy manufacturer Mattel just revealed its first Barbie doll representing a person with Down syndrome. Mattel worked closely with the National Down Syndrome Society, or NDSS, to create the Barbie. Specific design features of the new Barbie were made under guidance from NDSS. The doll has some physical characteristics of a person with Down syndrome, and the Barbie's clothing and accessories carry what they are calling special meaning. The blue and yellow on the doll's dress, accompanied by butterflies, represents symbols and colors associated with Down syndrome awareness. The three chevrons on the Barbie's necklace represent how people with Down syndrome have three copies of their 21st chromosome, or trisomy 21. The Barbie also wears foot orthotics, which are used by some children with Down syndrome. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Down syndrome is the most common chromosomal condition diagnosed in the U.S. today. About 6,000 babies are born across the country each year with Down. The new Barbie is part of Mattel's 2023 Fashionistas line, which is aimed at increasing diversity and inclusivity. Previous dolls in that line included a Ken doll with a prosthetic leg, a Barbie with hearing aids, and dolls with a skin condition called vitiligo. NDSS President and CEO Candy Pickard said, quote, "This means so much for our community, who for the first time can play with a Barbie doll that looks like them. This Barbie serves as a reminder that we should never underestimate the power of representation," end quote. Mattel said, quote, "We are proud to introduce a Barbie doll with Down syndrome to better reflect the world around us and further our commitment to celebrating inclusion through play," end quote.
President Biden formally announces his run for re-election. Massachusetts Democrats call for expanding the United States Supreme Court, and singer and activist Harry Belafonte dies at age 96. With these stories and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Wall Street didn't build America. The middle class built America, and unions built the middle class. They did.
President Biden gathered with members of the North American Building Trade Unions Tuesday after he formally announced his re-election campaign for 2024. In a video posted on social media, Biden asked Americans for more time to finish the job, and he warned of what he called mega extremists working to take away America's bedrock freedoms. Biden warned it is not time to be complacent, as a rematch between himself and former President Donald Trump appears likely. Representative Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts is joining fellow Democrats in calling for an expansion of the U.S. Supreme Court.
The court is meant to ensure equal justice under the law, but in its current configuration, the highest court repeatedly overturns the will of the majority of the people.
Presley says the Constitution gives Congress the power to expand the size of the court, and Congress has already used the power six times in history. She says the overturning of Roe v. Wade and financial disclosure scandals involving Justice Clarence Thomas have led to the public's historically low confidence in the court.
Work all night on a drink of rum.
Singer, actor, and longtime civil rights activist Harry Belafonte has died at age 96. His version of the Jamaican work song Deo popularized calypso music, and he became one of the first black performers to gain a wide following in segregated America. Belafonte was a close ally of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and a fierce critic of America's presidents for not doing enough to end poverty. Federal regulators have unveiled a plan to enforce existing civil rights laws against artificial intelligence systems that perpetuate discrimination. Federal Trade Commission Chair Lena Khan says AI tools are being used to engage in unfair hiring and banking decisions.
The FTC is firing on all cylinders to fully execute on our mandate to promote fair competition and protect Americans from unfair or deceptive practices.
The Biden administration on Tuesday criticized a House GOP proposal to tie a debt limit increase with spending cuts. But Representative Tom Cole of Oklahoma says three of four Americans want the national debt addressed.
Spending, spending, and more spending has been the theme of the Biden presidency.
Republicans say a vote on the legislation will take place this week. 11% of local election officials say it's likely they'll quit before the 2024 election, according to a survey from the Brennan Center for Justice. 30% of local election officials say they've personally been abused, harassed, or threatened because of their work. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Not all persons of faith in Nebraska support abortion bans. Deborah Van Fleet tells us more.
Identifying as a person of faith is not synonymous with supporting LB 626, the six-week abortion ban bill in the Nebraska legislature. In February, 120 Nebraska clergy from five different faiths signed on to a full-page ad opposing LB 626, which ran in Nebraska's three largest newspapers. It was paid for by the Nebraska Religious Council for Reproductive Freedom and two Omaha churches, including Omaha's Urban Abbey Methodist Church. Reverend Deborah McKnight, Urban Abbey's founding pastor, experienced the importance of reproductive freedom firsthand when she had a miscarriage at 12 to 13 weeks of pregnancy.
I just can't even imagine if part of that time would have been the doctor having to clarify with a hospital attorney or a legislator or anybody else what's the next best step for my health and well-being.
In 2020, the March of Dimes classified 70% of Nebraska counties as maternity care deserts, and in 2022 gave the state a D for preterm births. McKnight says if Nebraska legislators had the best interests of women and families in mind, they'd be debating bills to strengthen maternal health care, affordable child care, and early childhood education. McKnight maintains that on the subject of abortion, the Christian voice, including of evangelicals, has been corrupted by conservative political efforts.
And so I would want to be clear that Christianity has a diversity of voices, and you don't have to understand this pro-birth narrative as the only appropriate Christian response.
Wendy Goldberg, a longtime member and former president of the Congregation of Temple Israel, says the value of human life is very important in Judaism, and especially the life of the mother.
For any physical or mental health need, the life and the choice of the mother to be able to have reproductive health care is a priority and I believe essential in our state in order to protect religious freedom.
Goldberg says abortion is about both gender equity and the value of humanity, and that it's important to identify the thought leaders in the lane.
In this lane, the thought leaders should be medical professionals. And our medical professionals are advising us that this is a decision to be made between a woman and her doctor.
LB 626 was advanced in the first round of debate earlier this month. Round two of the three it has to pass to become law is scheduled for Thursday, April 27th. For Nebraska News Connection, I'm Deborah Van Fleet.
Washington Governor Jay Inslee signed a trio of gun bills into law yesterday. One prohibits the future sale, distribution, manufacture, and importation of more than 50 types of semi-automatic guns. The law was scheduled to take effect immediately, but it quickly drew a legal challenge. Another one of the laws he signed requires gun manufacturers and sellers to use reasonable controls over the sales of weapons and allows them to be sued over damages or violations. The third mandates a 10-day waiting period on gun purchases. Oregon's own gun control measure, number 114, continues to be tied up in judicial rulings and court cases.
A new law in Washington state helps in workers' comp cases. Eric Tegetoff has more on the story.
With the legislative session wrapped up, workers say Washington state lawmakers have handed them a victory when it comes to workers' compensation cases. Legislators passed House Bill 1068, which allows workers to record medical examinations of their injuries. Joe Kendo with the Washington State Labor Council says this is important when someone's claim for compensation is appealed, to ensure that doctors are providing thorough exams.
That is a policy that addresses a lot of concerns that we've heard from injured workers who have gone through this experience, which can be pretty uncomfortable and traumatic.
Kendo notes workers have a lot on the line in these cases. He says their ability to retain their wage replacement benefits or get the medical treatment they need hinges on the opinion of doctors in these examinations, adding that these specialists are not their usual doctors. Kendo says the bill has been introduced multiple years in a row.
It's one of those classic fights that pits workers and employers against each other. Their interests can diverge pretty dramatically in the space, and so finally seeing it cross the finish line was pretty satisfying.
Opponents have expressed concern that the law could lead to fewer doctors who are willing to provide exams. The legislation is currently on Governor Jay Inslee's desk. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU News in Depth, where we'll be speaking with Shannon Duncan, author of the new book, Coming Full Circle, Using Psychedelics to Heal Trauma. At 6, it's Project Censored. Then at 7, PDX Progressive Talk Radio. Tonight's weather, we'll see a lot of clouds with a low of 49. Tomorrow, though, a mix of clouds and sunshine and a high of 77. Friday looks to be even sunnier and warmer. So roll out those grills and find your sunglasses. Today in history, in 1996, the Chernobyl nuclear meltdown took place in the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. The quote of the day is from legendary comedian Carol Burnett, who is turning 90 today. She was born on this date in 1933. Burnett said, quote, "Comedy is tragedy plus time."
Pope Francis is giving women the right to vote in an upcoming meeting of bishops. This follows years of demands that women be given this right. He approved changes to the norms governing the Synod of Bishops, a Vatican body that gathers the world's bishops together for periodic meetings. The Vatican published that modification today. The historic reform appears to be a part of his vision for the lay faithful taking on a greater role in church affairs, formerly left to priests, bishops, and cardinals. Catholic women's groups, who have long criticized the Vatican for treating women as second-class citizens, immediately praised the move. The Women's Ordination Conference said, quote, "This is a significant crack in the stained glass ceiling," end quote. Popes have periodically summoned the world's bishops to Rome ever since Vatican II. At the end of these meetings, the bishops vote on specific proposals and offer them back to the Pope. He then produces a document said to take their views into account. Until now, the only people who could vote were men. But under the new changes, 5 religious sisters will join 5 priests as voting representatives. The Pope has also decided to appoint 70 non-bishop members of the Synod and has asked that half of them be women. They will have a vote as well. The aim is also to include more young people among those 70 non-bishop members.
The next meeting is scheduled for October and will be focused on making the church more reflective of and responsive to the laity, or regular Catholics. This follows a 2-year canvassing of Catholics about their vision for the church and how it can better respond to the needs of congregations today. So far, only one woman is known as a voting member of that October meeting. Sister Natalie Beccar, a French nun who is undersecretary in the Vatican Synod of Bishops' Office, will participate in the meeting because of her position. About 21% of the gathered representatives at the October meeting will be non-bishops, with half of that group women. It isn't clear how the female members of the meeting would be known, given that members have long been known as synodal fathers. The women themselves will decide if they want to be known as synodal mothers. Francis has so far upheld the Catholic Church's ban on ordaining women as priests.
U.S. and Canadian tribes are concerned about pollution coming from British Columbian coal mines. Concerns remain over more support for indigenous languages. And Oklahoma will allow Native students to wear formal tribal garb to graduation. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribes from the U.S. and Canada are again calling on government officials to stem pollution flowing from British Columbia coal mines into international waterways. Aaron Bolton reports the tribes say lack of action from both countries is harming fish populations.
More than 10 tribes issued an open letter calling on the U.S. and Canada to reach an agreement during bilateral talks this week that would stop selenium pollution from BC coal mines that's making its way into Lake Coconusa and the Kootenay and Columbia Rivers, all transboundary water bodies. Last month, President Joe Biden and Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced the two countries would strike a deal this summer to, quote, reduce and mitigate selenium pollution. The tribes are calling for both countries to authorize International Joint Commission involvement. The IJC settles transboundary water disputes between Canada and the U.S. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
Alaska Native language experts shared their personal stories at the state capitol last week. They were there to give an update on a Native Language Advisory Council and seek support for Indigenous languages. KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports.
Dr. Waukee Charles told a gathering of lawmakers and their staffers that at the age of 12, he was taken away from his home in Amonic and sent to a boarding school. He said his mother only spoke the Yupik language, or Yuktun, and didn't understand what happened to him.
Every time she heard a plane approaching to our village, that once a week, she was hoping I would be in that plane returning home, but I never did.
Charles said he was also ripped away from his heart language and didn't reconnect to it until he was in college. 2 years ago, Charles became the first Native director of the Alaska Native Language Center at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Yayuk Bernadette Alvana Stimful, an Inupiaq language leader, recalled what she felt as a child.
I could remember being a non-English speaker at 5 years old, making us to sing this song, I'm a little teapot, short and stout. In my five-year-old Inupiaq mind, say niungilanga, I am not a teapot.
Hune Lance Twitchell told the group that there are 23 Alaska Native languages, and a few of those are no longer spoken.
We don't like the word extinct. We prefer dormant, because we've seen languages come back.
Hune says with only 30 fluent speakers of Tlingit, it hasn't been easy to rescue his language, but it is possible.
Imagine if you could, if the English language went three generations without creating a single new speaker. Then imagine if you could, watching a child sit down at a table full of elders who could then speak to that child, and that child understands them.
In his work as head of the Native Language Program at the University of Alaska Southeast, Hune has helped to create a new generation of Tlingit speakers. He says those who work at the state capitol also have an important part to play.
Everybody who works in this building for the people, that when you walk through those doors every day, maybe you could just give yourself an affirmation, and that affirmation is this: no language dies on my watch.
I'm Rhonda McBride.
Oklahoma state lawmakers have approved a bill to allow Native students to wear traditional regalia to graduation. The bill passed the House this week. The Oklahoman reports schools in the state have come under scrutiny in recent years for trying to ban students from wearing eagle feathers or other regalia to graduation. The bill still needs to be signed by the governor. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Wisconsin wants to make investing in clean energy easier. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Solar farms are popping up across Wisconsin, and a new cooperative wants to make sure that everyone can benefit from the growing industry. Corey Neely is director of the SolarShare Wisconsin Cooperative. He says that to become members of the co-op, people pay a small fee, which is reduced for rural residents, veterans, and people of color. Then members can invest in local solar projects for as little as $1,000.
That lower $1,000 threshold was really important to us to make sure that the average person, if they were making an investment in a CD or something else, this is very comparable to that. And so it allows them to invest and find a different thing for their money that does good in their local community.
The co-op has two solar farms in development. When these projects come online, investors will start to make money.
We anticipate a 5% return over 5 years, so every $1,000 invested is $50 per year.
Neely says that's steady growth, not get-rich-quick money, but it can help people feel a sense of ownership in the clean energy economy.
And this gives people that peace of mind knowing that, hey, I know where my money's going. It's staying in our state. I call it local impact investing because they can point to that solar farm and just say, hey, that's our solar farm.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Illinois might become the first state to offer voting rights to all citizens, including incarcerated felons. Alex Gonzalez has more on the story.
Groups in Illinois are pushing to pass legislation to restore voting rights for all, including those who are currently incarcerated. According to Stand Up America, Illinois has the chance to make history by being the first state to restore voting rights for everyone. Last year, the group conducted a poll which found close to 60% of Illinois voters support legislative efforts that guarantee the right to vote for all citizens 18 and older, including those completing a sentence. Chicago native Avalon Betts Gaston says in 2015 she was wrongfully convicted for wire fraud and served time in federal prison. Today, she leads the Illinois Alliance for Reentry and Justice, one of the advocacy groups fighting for voter restoration. Betts Gaston says the right to vote creates community cohesion from inside or outside of jail.
When people are connected to their community and to their families in these ways, through civic engagement and things like that, they are less likely to commit harm in their current environment and also commit harm in their communities once they return.
Betts Gaston says those opposed to voter restoration argue that when someone is incarcerated, they should lose their right to vote as part of the punishment. She counters by saying the sentence is the punishment and everyone has the right to advocate for their community. According to the Sentencing Project, nearly 30,000 Illinoisans are disenfranchised because of a felony conviction. Katrina Fidd with Chicago Votes says they support voter restoration because they believe democracy works better when more people are involved. Fidd says those in prison are still citizens and have needs, many of whom have families. She adds the dehumanization of the prison population is an issue that complicates measures like this one. Fidd adds many aren't aware of who really is in the state's prisons.
We also know that this is a racial issue, too. I mean, 55% of people in Illinois prisons are Black, even though Black people make up less than 15% of the overall state's population. Disenfranchisement and that silencing, it has long-term consequences.
Fidd says the Illinois Constitution states the right to vote must be restored not later than upon completion of one sentence. She says in order to be compliant with the Constitution, this proposed legislation says 2 weeks after a conviction is when one's right to vote would be restored. For Illinois News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Well, it's Wednesday, and that means KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is here. Today, Dan does not want another shovel.
As the old saying goes, when you find yourself in a hole, the first step is to stop digging. America's going the wrong way. Fewer folks with more of the money, not caring about what most of the people's health, hope, and future. There's no profit in fixing global warming, global overpopulation. So America's top shovel, Joe Biden, says he wants to keep digging. This is leadership? While the Republicans, who don't even acknowledge our country's in a hole, figure if we continue fighting each other for the little scraps of sunlight that make it down here, they can continue to bask in the rising heat and sea levels. Is there a drug rehab program for power addiction? Where are America's leaders, not industry's leaders, financial leaders? That's not America. America is its people, its resources, its intelligence. When your only hope for change is a vote every 4 years and there's no one to vote for, what do you do? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 26th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael. The producer is myself, Josh Salem, and our engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tegetoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Deborah Van Fleet, Alex Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members, great folks like you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO's news in depth and have a great night.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Oregon voters passed ballot measure 109 back in November 2020, legalizing psilocybin for therapeutic uses. The Oregon Psilocybin Services Act is the first in the nation to create a legal framework for taking psilocybin, also known as psychedelic mushrooms. The law requires four different licenses to be in place before legal psilocybin therapy can be offered. Licenses for manufacturers, testing labs, facilitators, and service centers are needed. So far this month, the Oregon Health Authority licensed the first three psilocybin facilitators on April 18th. Last week, the OHA gave its first license to a testing lab, Rose City Laboratories. Oregon Psilocybin Services, which is under the umbrella of the Health Authority, estimates that the first psilocybin service centers will open